Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down, but when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/pod.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night with Hunter Thomas and Brody Smith. We're working with a little bit of a virtual situation going on here. So bear with us a little bit as we kind of figure out what it's going to look like when we have to film this remote versus when we're finally able to do it in person like we did last week. So no call-ins on this show, unfortunately. That's definitely something we want to bring back in the future. We will, however, be taking some like suggestions from you, the listeners, as to what we should talk about maybe a little bit later in the show as well, because from what I understand, I don't know what these are. But Brody, you're telling me you have a lot of lists.
Yeah, I think this is kind of how some of the shows might go. I think maybe in the future we'll see how this goes. I think maybe in the future, letting the other person know, like, hey, these are the topics, let's talk about, maybe giving them a few days to kind of think of some arguments or where they stand, that might be a good thing. But none of these are going to be very like, you're like digging at like, oh, I wish I could have researched this topic. Yeah. All these are pretty good topics. And then, like you said, we're going to open it up to the chat here at the end. But we did mention at the end of the last podcast, we asked you guys to go over to the Apple Podcast, subscribe over there, because I know this is a live show that we do on YouTube, but some people might be listening over there. But go over there, subscribe, and then drop us a review. And I've got one right here that I want to read from Navigator Kid. He said, hey, Hunter and Brody, just wanted to thank you for creating a podcast that is informative, engaging, funny, and overall a great listening experience. I love what you are doing for the sport of disc golf. Hashtag keep making them podcasts. I like that. So Navigator Kid, thank you for that. Make sure after the show, guys, just go over, drop us a review, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast, not only here on YouTube on the Foundation Podcast, but also on the Debate Night podcast on Apple Podcasts. I think I've said podcast enough. So we're moving forward to the first topic.
Let's hear it.
The first topic is gaming. If you haven't been paying attention, we're going a little bit off of disc golf. And that's the thing. I don't want to feel boxed in on this show.
I don't want to
feel like we can't talk about anything. Now, there are going to be a lot of disc golf topics,
yeah.
But I want to be a little bit more free. So we're going to talk about gaming a little bit. We've been going ham a little bit on Twitch lately. And if you've caught some of my streams and some of Foundation's streams, we just had a big Among Us game, which was pretty fun. But I want to ask you a question.
Okay.
What is the best style of game to stream?
Oh.
Because I'll start first by saying I streamed this, you know, those games where you just get like dropped in a room and you have no idea what's going on and you have to try to get out of the room. You find a flashlight, you find a knife, whatever. I just played 12 minutes. Okay. That's what the game's called. 12 minutes. I'm not going to spoil it, but I will say I got on the stream kind of late. It was like 8:30 or so at night. It got to 1:30 in the morning very quickly. And I literally had to take a pause and ask the stream, should I continue? And they said, you need to finish this game.
Oof.
it took me 5 hours to finish. I think I stopped streaming roughly around 2:30 in the morning.
Jeez.
It was out of control. But this game was unbelievable and people loved it. So I'm curious, what is the best game to stream on Twitch?
Okay, so I think there's two different types of ways to answer this, right? There's one, you have a following, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're the you're a person who has a following, it doesn't matter what the viewer enjoys. Then, like, me personally, I would say a first-person shooter in that case. Because, like, okay. For me, that's what I enjoy the most. Okay. Yeah. Two, the second flip side of that coin is you don't really have a following. You're trying to build a following on Twitch. Then you need the type of game that everyone's just going to have fun watching. So I think that's where something where it's more intense, it causes a little bit more fast paced, something like Rocket League, I think. Because this is from our experience. From us, we didn't have a following on Twitch. We still kind of don't. Rocket League, people love because it's so fast paced. The games churn over. Fall Guys, same type of thing where the games are constantly going. And even Fortnite to some degree, just because there can be a lot of action. But for instance, when we played Warzone, Minecraft, Sea of Thieves, games that were like, you get in and they're like a little bit more of a grind, a little bit of a
like
longer game.
World. Yeah.
Yeah. Where there might not be action every 5 minutes or every 5 seconds, then a lot of people are going to come on, watch for a few seconds and then click off. So I think fast paced games that are also like challenge based.
I think you're right there too. And I would say this too, there are some streamers that get so locked into a game. And one of my favorite streamers is Tim the Tapman.
Yeah.
And this, he kind of had to go through this transition of where everyone knew him for Overwatch. Mm. So whenever he was starting to branch away, because at a certain point, like, you have to realize, like, you can't continue. One, you will go insane if you play the same game every single day for years. But you also want to branch out and you want to play other games.
Yeah.
So he kind of went through that a little bit because he boxed himself a little bit into the corner. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think what you said, though, was important, where at the end of the day, you should be streaming something that you enjoy.
Well, I think that makes the people enjoy it more.
Disc Golf Valley.
Yeah, I saw someone say that. That's a great game.
Should we do a Disc Golf Valley stream?
I'm 100%. Trevor is apparently filthy at Disc Golf Valley. He hypes himself up a lot.
Is there like a doubles thing that we can do to where Trevor can be on my team?
I don't think so. I don't think they have the doubles update in there yet.
Okay.
But
fair
Disc Golf Valley, but yeah, I think, well, part of it, this goes with anything with social media, right? Is you have to enjoy what you're putting out, because if you're sitting there and, like, for instance, Trevor got burned out on Rocket League when we were streaming. So as the game would go on, the first 30 minutes, people love it. As we get to an hour, 2 hours in, Trevor gets a little burnt out. I'm still having the time of my life, but it's hard to feed off of. And so then when you get burnt out,
you feel that.
Yeah, the whole stream can feel it. So then people don't want to watch as much. Same thing with a YouTube video. Same thing with if your Instagram post. When you're really excited, you just produce better stuff.
Yeah.
So when you're really excited about whatever game you're playing, you're going to have that energy and you're going to be more excited and you're going to produce a better stream.
1,000%. And you could probably see that if you guys watch some of Foundation Disc Golf's recent videos. I actually don't know if some of those might go on the second channel. I'm not sure. But if you watch the ones that I'm in, we filmed all three of those. I'll spoil some stuff. But we have a scuba video coming out. We have a how fast can you throw video coming out. And then you guys saw the all sports battle. We filmed those all in the same day. And that was like one of the first days of me being like out, I would say, and like trying to do stuff after COVID. And you're 100% right. Like, my energy level was so low. So I'm hoping it doesn't come through too much in the videos.
Well, the all sports battle, I don't think it mattered because people loved that we were miserable.
Yeah, but I was like double miserable because I was getting crushed.
Which made it double funny to people at home.
I felt like I needed to take a nap.
Yeah, the scuba video I think will go over very well. How fast can you throw? Those are both going on our second channel. If you're not subscribed over there yet,
I want to rematch immediately. I figured out I wasn't getting my hips involved.
And
I
did that for the speed?
Today. Yeah, I started getting my hips involved today. Ooh, boy. I'm getting back up.
When you move back up, when you move up here, we'll have to get the speed gun in front of all of us and Paul.
Yeah.
I'm very curious. I was pretty happy with
Paul.
Yeah, I was happy with what I was putting up speed gun number wise. I won't spoil what those numbers were yet, yeah. But
you guys were at your ceiling and I felt like I was barely sniffing the first floor. So
I don't know if I'd go that far. Okay, my first side note, speaking about speed gun, because you just said ceiling, golf, right? You're talking about club head speed. What's so mind-boggling to me is how, I'm assuming it's the same in disc golf. I don't think we've studied it enough, but like, I was out there, right? And after 5 or 6 swings, I was able to get my driver club head speed to 100.
Yeah, so for people that don't know, we busted out the speed gun right outside the office, and Hunter for some reason had his golf clubs in the office, and we're moving everything. So he's like, I need to get these out of here. And I think he did. You claim you couldn't swing over 100.
I said there was no way I could swing over 100. You said I could.
And you said you could swing your 7-iron faster than your driver.
Yeah,
which
I told you that
is absolutely insane. But continue on. Just to give a little background, what the heck's going on here?
Yeah. So, but what's crazy to me is you're saying the top people on tour are only swinging like 120 miles an hour. So like, to me, in my head, that's not that big of a gap, but obviously that gap is drastic once you start training. So I'm interested, like in disc golf, if we were to consistently spit, like where is the gap of like, let's say that I'm at mid 60s and then Simon's only, let's say mid 70s. I don't know if those numbers are accurate, but like that 10 mile per hour gap feels like that's a huge gap. You know what I mean? But sounding wise, it's not that big.
Well, I mean, we've played enough together too to see like how far I throw and how far you throw, and when I'm throwing, you know, when I'm throwing well, I'm throwing like mid 70s. I'm throwing 75, 76. You're throwing in the 60s, and it'd be really interesting because in golf they actually have like the technology and all the stats and data and all that stuff to be able to say like every mile per hour you increase your club head speed is 3 yards basically.
Interesting.
But a lot of that obviously has to go like this is what I was talking about to you. You could swing 100 miles per hour with the driver, and I could swing 100 miles per hour with the driver, and my ball is going to go way further than yours because I'm going to probably hit in a sweet spot more than you.
Yeah.
But all right, let's switch to another topic. This was a big one on Twitter for me. I brought home Reese's one night, and Kelsey straight up asked me, you know, she said, hey, I see a bag here, you know, it looks like there's some drinks and some stuff in there, like did you bring home any candy? And I, you know, in my head I know Reese's is candy, I know it, right? But I was just kind of playing it off by being like, no, I don't have any candy, no. And she looked in, she's like, there's Reese's, what is this? And I was trying to play it off as it's chocolate, it's not candy. Now, there are so many different ways we can go about this, but the question at the end of the day is chocolate considered candy? And my stance is no. Chocolate is its own category that can be used in candy.
It's its own category of what?
Similarly to peanut butter, to nuts, like those things aren't candy, but they could be put into something that then makes it candy. And the question is too, M&Ms. This was another thing tweeted to me. M&Ms. It says on the M&Ms wrapper, chocolate covered candy.
Candy covered chocolate, but
why don't they say can't? What?
Candy covered chocolate.
Is that what it says?
Well, you don't M&M. The outside's not chocolate.
Yeah, it is.
What's the inside of an M&M then?
A nut.
What? M&M well, like, inside is not a nut. No.
Well, no, wait, hold on. The inside of an M&M, well, like a
base M&M.
The peanut M&M, but the inside of a normal M&M.
Because I would argue the most candy part of an M&M is the outside. Now I got to Google that. At first, Googled candy definition.
What the heck is inside an M&M? It definitely says chocolate-covered.
Is it chocolate-covered candy?
Yeah. It 100% says that.
It says made with real chocolate. Milk chocolate M&M. Chocolate candies.
You got to go to... where was that?
The inside is literally milk chocolate.
Where was the chocolate-covered candy?
I think someone just responded to you on Twitter.
Yeah, they did. I don't know where they got that photo. But it literally said chocolate-covered
candy. M&M's are multicolored, button-shaped chocolates. So they're just chocolates. Right. Consisting of a candy shell surrounding a filling, which depends. So the shell's okay. The candy. The inside's...
This is where I think I rest my case. Okay, because you can't have, exactly, you can't have candy-covered candy.
Yeah, you can.
That makes no sense. Definition, okay, definition of candy.
Yep.
And this is where I think chocolate isn't in. Because here's a question for you, Hunter. Is there candy-flavored ice cream? Because there's chocolate-flavored ice cream.
But what flavors candy? Candy's a broad category.
So is chocolate.
No, chocolate's under the category of candy. Chocolate's the most popular form of candy.
And this right here is why candy and chocolate are separate and chocolate is not a candy. Similar to, would you say fruit's a candy?
No, fruit's not a candy.
Would you say nuts are a candy?
Candied nuts are a candy, yeah.
But just nuts?
Nuts, no.
Okay, definition of candy. Coming from Oxford, you can't disagree with Oxford. Candy, a sweet food made with sugar or other sweeteners, typically formed in small shaped pieces and flavored with chocolate, fruit, or nuts. Boom. Okay, let's move on to the next topic.
That doesn't make any sense. No.
Let's move on to the next topic.
Okay, so avoid the typically flavored with part. Okay, avoid, because that's just typically. Okay.
Read the first half. Flavored with chocolate?
Read the first half of the, because like you can have chocolate candy, like flavored candies.
We're talking just chocolate,
but that's just a candy flavored candy.
Someone just gave you a piece of chocolate.
Yeah, they gave you a piece of candy. Say,
I know you.
If I hand you a Tootsie Roll, do I hand you candy?
I don't know if Tootsie Roll is a chocolate.
That's just awful chocolate. Pretty sure it's what Tootsie Roll is.
I don't think it is.
I'm pretty certain.
There's no way.
What about those little Lint truffle things that are individually wrapped?
The heck are you talking about? You're picking the worst.
That's like my favorite candy.
Okay, someone hands you, literally, they have a brick of chocolate and they break off a piece and they hand it to you. You're not going to say thank you for that candy. You're not going to say thank you for this candy. You're going to say thank you for this chocolate. Someone hands you a Jolly Rancher. Thanks for this candy.
I'm going to say thanks for the Jolly Rancher.
Everyone's saying Tootsie Roll is not chocolate, and I agree completely.
Only time I'm using the word candy is if I don't know what the specific candy is.
You know what I think we need to have?
But chocolate has transcended candy, but it's a form of candy. Chocolate started under the category of candy, but has gotten bigger than the category itself. It has become the most popular candy out there. But it is still a candy. It's just transcended it.
That's a bad take. I don't think so. I think chocolate was around before candy.
Now, see, that's an argument that I don't know.
There's no
way chocolate might have been the first candy. Okay, well, it depends on what you're saying about chocolate. Like, dark chocolate that doesn't have sweetener added to it, not candy.
I don't even think that's chocolate.
That's
man.
Not candy. That's strict chocolate. That's not candy. Milk chocolate, once you add stuff to it and sweeten it up, that's candy.
Correct. I'm with you.
When you say chocolate, what chocolate flavored ice cream isn't dark chocolate flavored ice cream? It's milk chocolate flavored ice cream. It's candy flavored ice cream.
No, if you add something to the chocolate, you're making candy.
Okay, so you're saying pure cocoa is not chocolate. Like a pure 100%
This is where we need to have Connor come in with the mallet of justice and the mallet of truth, hit it down, say, Brody, you won this argument. We're going to the next. I think we leave this for the audience.
Well, I need to look up one thing. I just need to look up Tootsie Roll.
You guys let us know. Do you think chocolate is candy? I don't think so. Hunter does.
260 count Tootsie Roll Mega Chocolate Candy Mix. It's a chocolate candy. Chewy chocolate candy. That's from Tootsie Roll's website.
Yeah, obviously. They're going to try and market the crap out of that. Everyone knows that
Tootsie Roll is just awful chocolate.
I don't know. I actually personally love Tootsie Rolls, and I really like the long stick ones. Okay.
Okay. Never mind.
The next thing we're going to talk about, we're going to disc golf here. We're going to be talking about something that I think needs to change, and I'm curious to see what you think.
Okay.
I think right now the way – and again, this is only – when I talk about stuff, I'm only talking about the pro tour. I'm only talking about the highest of levels. I'm not talking about changing your leagues or any of that stuff. Only talking about the pro tour here, guys. I think the way the scoring is done right now in the Pro Tour is not good. I don't think it's good. I don't think it's good for the players. I don't think it's good for the fans. I think it's just awkward, and I think also it opens up the door for – and this is actually not at the highest level. This is at other levels. I think the way that scoring is done – it opens up the door for people to cheat in like flex starts, C tiers and B tiers. It's harder to cheat with like pencil whipping and like changing your scores and stuff on the Pro Tour. But I do think it puts people in a weird position. And this is what I'll say about that. After a hole, having to, and this is what most cards do. They'll have one person on the card step up to the tee pad and say, okay, Hunter, what did you get? A 4, okay. Trevor, what'd you get? A 5, okay. Connor, what'd you get? A 7? You got a 7? Okay. I don't like that one because if you are the guy that got a 7, like you don't want to have to relive that. You don't want to have to say that out loud. And so I think that kind of just looks weird and doesn't look professional. And then I think the other thing on it is it makes it to where the cheating and awkwardness comes from, to where if I know someone got a 4 and they're claiming they got a 3, I now am put in a position where I have to say, like, are you sure you got a 3? And it's an awkward situation. So I have a solution, but I'm curious as to what you feel about the scoring the way it's set up currently. Before I even talk about the solution.
I mean, to be honest with you, I've never really thought about it that much. I've been in situations where players have taken an 8, right? And they say 6 after. And I just go, oh, I had you at an 8. Let's just recount real quick. I've never felt like that was an awkward situation. But I think I need to hear your solution as to, because I don't really see this being a problem, more so because I don't really see a better way around it.
It slows pace of play.
Okay.
Right? And that's something that we on Foundation have talked, and you guys on Griplocked have talked a lot about, is how can we speed up the game? How can we have less things? And so if you're not having these 30-second meetings on figuring out what the score is every single hole, that right there wipes away 9 minutes. And also, if I'm a fan, it's a weird thing to like be standing. If I'm standing on the tee pad and I'm hearing this discussion, I think it's a weird thing. Coming from golf, I think it's a weird thing.
So what's your proposed solution?
Is my solution. You give me a scorecard. You get a scorecard. Trevor gets a scorecard. Connor gets a scorecard.
Mm-hmm.
I hand you my scorecard. You hand Connor your scorecard. Connor hands me his scorecard. Trevor hands the other person his scorecard, whatever. So we all end up having someone else's scorecard, right? So if I have your scorecard, I'm keeping your score on where? Well, yeah, there we go. I'm keeping your score on the top, okay? So all the square, there's 18 squares right here. So after the first hole, Hunter got a 4. After the second hole, Hunter got a three. Okay, and I'm keeping your scores. On the bottom, there's a perforated edge right here, and that's where I keep my scores. I got a two, I got a three, or actually, sorry, reverse that. My scores are up top, perforated edge are your scores, Hunter. Okay. So when the round ends, all of your scores are on the bottom. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tear the perforated edge, because my official scorecard is the one I'm keeping. I'm going to tear the official, I'm going to tear the perforated edge, and I'm going to hand it to you, and I'm going to say, hey, this is what I have. And so what you then do is you have your scores at top, you take the my scores that I have, you line it up literally right below, and you literally just go, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5. Oh, 4-3. I got a 4 on this one. You have a 3. And then we can go back and discuss it and go through it again and figure it out. But that way, there's very less room for cheating. And also, I'm only having to keep, you know, track of one other person's score, which is way easier. And we don't have to have these 30-second conversations on the T-pad. And then also it puts all the onus again on me for keeping the right score. Because that's one thing that happens right now that's kind of weird is I have to check someone else's work to make sure I don't get penalized for my score, where I'm going to literally – I should be able to keep my score and say this is what I got, sign it, turn it in. And if something ends up coming back that it's wrong, then I get penalized. And that's on me because I literally kept my own score. But my big thing with this is I just don't want to have to, like, sit there and wait for everyone to say their scores. I don't want to do it. Like, we get to a tee pad. If it's open to throw, whoever's up should just step on the tee pad and go. And, you know, I think we've all played in tournaments where – the person is, you know, ready to throw, and the guy that's like keeping the scores is like, oh, hold on, oh, sorry, and they're like fumbling with it, and they're trying, okay, whatever, and you're ready to go. So it's just pace of play, I think, the professionalism, I think, and just overall, like, it's just a small thing that really would just be super easy.
So how are you getting the other person's score? You're just responsible to pay attention to it?
Yeah, what the heck? You threw one into the tree. You threw the second one in the fairway. You threw the third one into circle. You missed your putt. You missed your putt. You got a six.
Okay, now what if, like, he's off the fairway, he actually took an eight because there's two throws you didn't see that you hit the first tree?
He's off the fairway?
Like, he's off to the left, deep in the woods.
Well, aren't you technically, isn't it the rule you're technically supposed to watch everyone's throw?
Yeah, you're supposed to be, but, like, sometimes a dude goes to chuck it, he hits a tree, it drops straight down. He's like, crap. And you're like, did he actually throw that? Or what happens? I feel like...
I think in that situation, if you really wanted to address it right then and there, as soon as the hole's out, you can say, hey, man, I think you got a seven on that hole. Would you? Is that what you got? Like, as you're walking to the next tee. Gotcha. And it can just be a conversation between
the
two of you.
Now, the second question...
I think that's fine.
Second question I have about it would be, wouldn't it almost make cheating be a little bit easier if I'm keeping my own official score and you're keeping the, like, one I check it against, and then you hand it to me and I'm like, okay, cool. And I, like, oh, I have a three here, but Brody wrote I had a four.
There's no
I'm just not going to say. Pencils. Oh, so you turn both in.
What's that?
No, like, I'm keeping my own score. I don't need to erase anything. I take a four on hole three.
I end up checking it as well. It's not like you just check and then you're done. Like, I check as well. You check. Like, I check mine, then we switch. Does that make sense?
Because we're both checking.
I have to sign my scorecard, and I have to sign the players that I took score. So when the round's over, what ends up happening is you break the perforated edge. You hand it to the other person. You just go, yeah, sounds good. And then you switch. And then it's like, yeah, sounds good. You sign and you get out of there. If you watch golf tournaments, they've shown some of this sometimes, especially when there's a playoff and stuff and the coverage is still going to go. It's literally like a 15 or 20 second process is how long it takes. And let me say that's way faster than having a cell phone and handing it around to everyone. and then having to type in their PDGA number. And so,
that's a unique situation right now.
I'm saying the speed of it. The speed is there.
Typically, you're double checking it on a paper scorecard, and you possibly have to initial.
Sure.
But yeah.
I think the biggest
time saver is during the round. After the round, I think it might save a minute when it's all been done.
What I was just trying to say is it's not – I didn't want people to think like, oh, this is going to take forever for people. Like if the round ends, I just want to get out of here.
Yeah.
And sometimes that happens, right? Like I've played with people sometimes where they played bad and like the person's like, hey, I have you as a 60. They're like, whatever. And they're walking out. And there's no – I don't know. That's kind of my thought on it. But – it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens with that moving forward.
I think the disc golf might have been the World Tour. It might have been the World Tour back in the day. USDGC did it?
I think USDGC scoring I think is different.
But
it's not the Pro Tour.
I want to say the World Tour when that was a thing when the Pro Tour was first starting, everyone had their own scorecard and. The metrics weren't actually live. Maybe the actual lead card was, but you kept track of, it might've been your score and one other person's score. And then every three holes was a scoring booth and you just hand it to them. I forget how it exactly worked. Basically you used to for live scoring, hand your scorecard into the booth because we didn't have enough phones and everything. And the booth would plug it in really quick or take a picture of it and upload it for the live scoring. So then us at home, every three holes got an update. But you, in that scenario, you were keeping only one person scored in stats and everyone was. I don't know if they had your own on there or if I was only keeping yours and you were only keeping Trevor's and Trevor was only keeping Connor's and so on. It might have been that, but I definitely could see that changing as things move forward.
It's one of those situations too. Golf does it this way. There's probably they probably have a way better reason for doing it that way than what I posed of just saving time, we talked about the 9 minutes of speeding up pace of play. I'm sure there's other reasonings other than just the cheating and the pace of play, but I don't know why that would be a bad thing. I know there's probably gonna be some pushback from people listening because whenever you propose something changing, there's just pushback. People don't, they're just going to say that's a stupid idea. And it's okay, well, explain why it's a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Because golf does it. So if you're saying it's a stupid idea, then you're basically saying what golf does right now is stupid. But,
There's a lot of people that would say that would be the reason to be like, yeah, I think golf's stupid. If you came with that argument.
Well, fair enough. Okay. Interesting story. Next topic. When I was at Worlds and doing a practice round at what was the terrible course? Mulligan's. Doing a practice round at Mulligan's, I bumped into a guy and he comes up to me and he's like, Brody, listen. He goes, do you think the future of disc golf, do you think we haven't even reached our potential? And I was like, I mean, I think there'll be better players, more athletic. The money will be higher, so people will be able to dedicate and spend more time. So I think it'll definitely get better, but I don't think we're that far away. I just think there's not a deep field. And he goes, no. He goes, I think eventually there'll be someone that throws right-handed backhands, left-handed backhands, right-handed forehands, left-handed forehands. I think that's the future. So essentially what he was saying was saying that at some point to be really good at disc golf, you'll have to be ambidextrous and be able to throw right-handed backhand, left-handed backhand, right-handed forehand, left-handed forehand. What do you think about that?
Is it an awful idea? No. I mean, here's my biggest thing. I mean, if someone was good enough at it, sure, it'd be sick. But several players have proved that your right-hand forehand can get as good as someone's left-hand backhand. You might be missing just a little bit of touch because of spin control. But I have a hard time believing. I think that what would more happen is the like actual science behind our form will develop enough that how people are throwing forehands and backhands with their right hand will change.
Get the most potential.
Yeah, because a tennis player isn't learning. I think tennis, a lot of ways, I think tennis, like whatever the scientific name for how our form is, I think tennis is very close to like the muscles we use, and because like a backhand,
forehand,
you don't see Roger Federer randomly switching to his left hand for a forehand unless he's like trying to swan dive out there and it's a last ditch effort. He's not routinely.
The only thing you see in tennis is a two-handed forehand.
Yeah, but so you're not routinely seeing him go right hand forehand, left hand forehand, depending on which side the ball came on. So, I mean, it's just because he's never going to have the same power with his left hand forehand as he does with his right hand forehand or his right hand backhand. That just doesn't make sense. So I think that's the same thing going forward in disc golf. Is like an ambidextrous player might come along and they might be able to compete on the pro tour, sure, but it's not something that like a 10-year-old right now should be worrying. Yeah, it's not like basketball where you have to be able to go left, because that's a whole different side of a game. Whereas in disc golf,
throwing the forehand accomplishes it. I think in basketball it is definitely beneficial to be able to go. You're talking about like off the dribble.
No, I'm saying in basketball you have to be able to go left. That's a part of the game.
Oh yes, yeah. I'm saying it's
not like that. Disc golf's not like that, where like it's not a part of the game that you have to be able to throw a left hand backhand. Because you can accomplish it with a right hand. I'm glad you said that, because probably the way I worded it, probably everyone was saying at home, like, did Hunter just say you don't have to have a left hand in basketball?
Tennis was a really good analogy. Another really good one is pitchers in baseball. I don't think I could be wrong, but I don't think there is a major league pitcher that, based off the hitter, they switch from throwing right handed and throwing left handed.
No, I think there's teams that'll switch. A team will switch their pitcher mid-game so you get a little...
Yeah, they'll pull their right-handed pitcher out that started and bring in their left-handed closer, for sure. Now, there are switch hitters in baseball, but those guys will tell you, and the stats prove it, that they're clearly better on one side than the other. And the only time they're really switch hitting is based off of the pitcher. So my thought is it might not be so much as when you're born, you're like you're right hand dominant or left hand dominant, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's as much importance as time. I think the time of practice and all that stuff, that is the most important. Disc golf has so many different elements that you have to practice to get to the top level, that if you are now adding two new elements, a left-handed backhand and a left-handed forehand, you are now adding way more things to practice. And when you do that, I think instead of you becoming a better player, I think what's going to end up happening is something in your game is going to get worse, whether it's putting, whether it's your scrambling, whether it's your upshots or your distance or whatever, something is going to get worse because you're going to end up having less time to practice everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, a great example sticking within disc golf even is James Conrad. He has a forehand, but he doesn't really use it, right? But he's been able to stay atop the ranks for years now in the top 15 and win Worlds this year, where there's plenty of players who have, like, Eagle McMahon always comes to mind when I'm thinking of great forehands and backhands. Eagle can throw a forehand farther than 95% of players in the world can throw a backhand, and with just as much control. And yet one player with basically just a backhand is able to beat him. And so to me, it's like you can develop these things. You might get really, really good, but you can accomplish every shot with a backhand to where you can just – the forehand almost adjusts the spin, so you can have, like, different benefits to that. But once you accomplish both spins, you can accomplish every shot shape there is out there. And then you can add in grenades and tomahawks and stuff to where going right-hand forehand to left-hand backhand, I don't really think that's that big of a difference. If you're able to perfect both, I don't think you're seeing that big of a drastic improvement in your game.
It'd be interesting I'm curious, too, how much time James spends in the off season on his forehand. Like, do you think he's like, do you think this offseason he's going to be grinding on getting his forehand better? Or do you think he's going to just spend all his time getting his, you know, jump putt, getting his turnover putter game? Because, like, to me, it's tough to think, and it goes to basketball too a little bit, right? Now, like, Shaq is a different breed. Shaq, I think a lot of the reasons why Shaq was so bad at shooting free throws was simply just his size. That might be a cop-out for Shaq because I like Shaq. But that's one of those things of, like, when you watch these NBA players not unable to shoot free throws, it's like, how are these guys just not like, oh, my gosh, I got to get better at shooting free throws. This offseason, I'm just going to shoot the crap out of free throws every day to figure it out. And that's kind of my question with James. It's like, there's no way that he has something, or I could be wrong. I don't think he said anything about, like, oh, I have like a torn rotator cuff or like tennis out. Like, he hasn't come out to say anything that has, like, he's injured or there's something causing him not able to perform a forehand as good as everyone else. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious as to what is the reason for him. Like, is it just simply like he thinks he can get by with his backhand and he doesn't need a forehand, so he doesn't work on it in the offseason?
I mean, it might be something like, I would imagine on the NBA side, probably like when you're going to practice, you have a list of things that you're trying to get better at, right? And I'm sure like free throws is on everyone's list, but a lot of times it doesn't feel that important. Like, yeah, it is important, but it's kind of like, I'm sure in disc golf, everyone has something that's like a part of their game that you're like, I don't use it that much. For Shaq,
well, people don't like practicing stuff they suck at.
Yeah, also, well, that's the other thing. For Shaq, it's,
like,
a little bit
different.
If you suck
at putting, you're probably not going to be grind. You're not going to probably be practicing that much putting.
Yeah, but for James, it might just be, again, we have no idea how much he's going to practice his forehand.
Yeah.
Stuff. He might come back as the best forehand player we've ever seen next year.
Would be sick.
But it might be something where he doesn't see that the forehand increasing his overall skill that much to where it's worth it yet.
Mm.
You also have to think, for years and years, a lot of disc golf courses were
backhand
designed to be backhand dominant. So like the turnover lines and stuff like that were cut in. Mm-hmm. Only courses designed and cut in within the last 4 or 5 years are really starting to have shots that you have to throw a forehand if you want to get there type thing, to where a lot of those courses might not even be on really like heavily on tour yet. Some are,
yeah.
But I mean, a lot of people, for instance, used to call USDGC the forehand championships, and James Conrad won that. So yeah. It just shows with a backhand.
Do you think James Conrad would be a better player if he had a top 20 forehand?
I think he'd be more consistent.
At, yes. Like, yeah, more consistent, like top 10 finishes.
I think he'd be in more
contention.
Consistent. Yeah, I think okay. He'd be more consistent, but. I've
you should
always
message
said,
him. Let him know.
Yeah. Who the heck am I to message him? But I think I've always said a backhand can accomplish way more than a forehand can. So like a forehand, you're not getting the same amount of rotations, your angle control and stuff like that. And you don't have the same reach back to get your hips in and everything. To where a backhand, you're going to be able to control, even just like changing up the grip, you can control and make it throw with a forehand spin level. You know, you can power grip, have a lot more spin. You can get a disc to flip easier. You can get a disc. You can do a lot more with a backhand than you can with a forehand, to where you are able to shape shots.
Off the tee.
Yeah, the only time a forehand comes in.
You can do more with a forehand, though, scrambling.
Scrambling, yeah. Absolutely. Because the biggest advantage of a forehand, you never have to turn your head away.
Yeah.
Backhand, if you want to get power, you have to turn your head away. Forehand, you can scramble and be looking straight at the gap you're trying to hit the whole time. So I will agree there, big time.
But forehand, too, you can also generate a lot more power with very limited movement.
Yeah.
Where a
almost
backhand
just your wrist.
Is. Yeah. And also your foot placement with a forehand. I can do a normal forehand where like my feet are stacked, mm-hmm. and then I can do one where they're out, or I can do one where like it's more of an angle. I can move my feet around a lot more with my forehand and feel comfortable than probably my backhand. So that's another thing to kind of think about too with James's game is, you know, there might be, like you said, there might be some situations that a forehand would be a lot more viable option than a backhand. And if he had a forehand, he might be putting himself in contention for more tournaments than he currently is, which is a scary thought. But as fans of disc golf, it's something that I think we all would want to see.
No, for sure. And I actually just thought of this back to the original point with the right hand, left hand ambidextrous thing. Back in the day when forehand was just becoming a bigger deal, Nico was like one of the top players in the world. He might actually have been number one rated in the world at the time. Instead of learning a forehand, he learned a left-hand backhand. So if you go back to coverage of it, I think it's USDGC like hole three, which I think last year might have been hole one, to like down the hill hole.
He would go
left-hand backhand on it because he wanted the forehand shot shape, but he just learned a left-hand backhand instead. And he used that for a few years. Now Nico will use a forehand, has a very serviceable, he has a good forehand. But for a while, he didn't put the time in to do it, and instead he was learning the left-hand backhand, which was an interesting play. So he just threw right-hand backhand, left-hand backhand, and then brought out a forehand only for, you know, rare occasions, basically.
Interesting.
So someone has kind of done it in the past.
What do we need to do? Okay, because obviously we did the whole shaving your head bet, which ended up you turning into Eminem for a couple weeks.
Yep.
What do we need to do a Foundation Milk Crate Challenge?
I refuse. I will not do that.
You're out.
No. I know myself. I'm way too injury prone, and I have shaky legs when I get up high. And putting those things together, my shoulder would be out the second I got on that top crate.
Who would be the best in Foundation to do the Milk Crate Challenge? Who would you put your money on? Because I think I know who I'm going with.
Sneakily, I think I'd put my money on Connor.
Wow.
I think I would. Really? Trevor and Connor would be the two. I think me and Silas have the least chance of getting up and over. Connor, I feel like, would...
I'm going Trevor.
You think Trevor?
I'm going Trevor. Because I think Trevor would be able to handle the moment. Because I think that's the big thing, is when they get to the top, you see the most people fall. And I think you guys discussed this a little bit. The most people fall on the first step down.
Yeah.
Like the people that are good, that first step down. And I think a lot of it has that mentality of like, I'm halfway there. All I need to do, like I've done the hard part. Now I think Trevor stays focused. I would be the worst. Maybe Silas. Me or Silas would be the worst.
Yeah. Well, because you have to add too another tall. 6 feet on top.
I'm now 20 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
I am now to where if I land wrong, I will die.
The thing with Trevor, the reason I didn't pick Trevor, one of the things is his nickname is Trimmer Stob. Because when you're in town, you'll have to look. He has a history of like shaky hands and stuff in his family. So I don't know if that translates to his legs.
That's shaky feet? Yeah,
I don't know.
That's shaky.
I don't know how that translates. If you put up wobbly surface below him, I don't know. Connor used to skateboard. Uh-oh. He's very confident balance-wise.
Are we adding in the wives for this? Because I think Kelsey actually would be the best.
I think I'm sticking with Connor, even with the wives added in.
Over Kelsey?
I think I'm sticking with Connor. I trust Connor's balance.
The dancer?
I think Connor's also before.
Kelsey would walk over it like she was walking on water. It would not look difficult.
I don't know. I think Connor would be slow and methodical about it and would take. I think Connor would do it. And Connor's also crazy enough that he'd probably try it. We just have to make sure it's not on company property.
See, I think if you hadn't seen any videos and you didn't know anything about it, and I just set it up and I was like, "Hey guys, this is what we're doing today," and I was like, "All right, Kelsey's gonna go first." And then she would just, you know, do it with ease. I think you would do it.
I would probably try it, and then I'd get to the top one, and my feet. The first time I saw it, I was like, "These idiots must be drunk or something who are falling on this. It looks so easy." And then I saw more and more people, and I saw like crazy athletic people do it, and I was like, "This must be really hard."
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm sticking with Connor.
Maybe if we hit 15,000 subscribers on this podcast channel. We'll do it.
I feel like Connor has said before that he has he's like crazy good at balance. I feel like that's something that's come up, and he said he has like a low center of gravity.
He has a hobby of balance?
No,
I think that's like a thing.
I feel like we've talked about something. He's just said before that he's very good at anything involving balance, he's good at.
I have a it's not called an indigo board. Indie board? It might be called
the thing with like the circle and then
cylinder. Yeah. There's a cylinder.
Like it's like a balance board thing.
Yeah. I have one of those. I'll bring it in.
See, I can do that.
We'll put some pads and stuff around, and we'll see who looks like they've got the best control.
Yeah, because that's just
and go from there.
Yeah,
that's balance.
I think I could do that pretty easily. I've used one of those before. And I think Connor could too. Connor has a skateboarding history.
That helps.
You got to have some crazy balance for skateboarding.
That helps. Okay. Jake Paul versus Tyron Woodley goes down
in a few hours.
By the time this is up, it's gonna be just about happening.
Well, this is live.
By the time this like is the podcast on Apple Podcasts.
I'm guessing that
will be up on Sunday. But the fight's tomorrow. Yeah, the fight's tomorrow. There's UFC fights tonight.
I got him confused.
It's just a fight night card. There's like three or four good fights. But tomorrow night is the Jake Paul versus Tyron Woodley. Let's first talk about it and then let's give predictions. So this fight, this is a big one. Okay. All his previous ones, like I love Ben Askren. I'm a big Ben Askren fan. Good friends with him. Clearly, he's a friend of Foundation. But going into that fight, I was very nervous for Ben. Very, very nervous. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that he also just had hip surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't something that he brought up. And that wasn't something that the media talked about. But he literally retired. And this was something that he had told us prior to doing it, is that he was basically trying to win the belt in the UFC. Once he, got the loss to Masvidal,
mm-hmm.
and realized like that wasn't probably going to happen. Once he got the loss to Masvidal, then he had to fight Damian Maia, who's like an absolute nightmare to fight, and he got choked out. He realized he was probably too far away to like get the belt. Right, he would have had to win like five fights in a row to get a chance. So like he was like, as soon as I'm done, I'm getting surgery, because his hip was absolutely jacked up. So he got surgery, went into that fight. He's a wrestler, he's not a boxer, and he got slept. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much time and effort Jake Paul is putting into boxing. And I think a lot of people just have this like, I don't think Jake Paul is a good person, and I don't really like a lot of the stuff he does, but I'm not going to discredit him for the amount of work and effort he's put into boxing. He's not taking it lightly. And so I think a lot of people don't think about that. They just think like, oh, Jake Paul sucks, he's not good at boxing. When in fact, it's like, if you do anything for 3 years and you put a lot of time and effort into it, you're probably going to be pretty decent at it. So I think this fight right here is a big one, not only because he is fighting someone that actually is coming with some sort of boxing pedigree. Like, Ben Askren has not knocked out a single person his entire life. Okay, there's no highlights of Ben hurting someone with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
Tyron Woodley has put people to sleep, and he's put killers to sleep. Now, he's fallen off a little bit, and he's lost, I think, his last four fights, I believe. But he has that power, and people know that. So I think this fight is huge, because not only is Jake fighting someone that actually is dangerous, but I think also if Jake wins, this can potentially show that boxing isn't that hard to get good at.
Mm.
Because it's, you know, someone like Woodley who has put tons and tons of time and effort and has been fighting forever. Okay. Fighting forever. Jake Paul just comes in 2 years, trains, and now he's knocking people out. Like if Jake Paul knocks out Tyron Woodley, I don't think that is going to be a good look for the actual sport of boxing, of like how difficult it is. Because right now, a lot of people are saying like, it takes forever. And I know he's not fighting a boxer. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just giving him credit. If he knocks out Woodley, that, I think that's a big thing, man. I think that's going to be a big, big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not a super combat sport fan, but I've followed the Jake Paul saga up to this point, yeah. Right? Because that's very entertaining and intriguing. And I think that Jake Paul has been very smart about how he's gone about it, right? Because he's been picking people that are progressively more impressive, mm-hmm. but that he knows, based on his own opinion of himself, that he can beat. So that's why whenever someone's asked me, I know we're not at predictions yet, but I'll go ahead and give mine. Whenever someone's asked me, I think Jake Paul's going to win, just because I think that he's being very strategic and very smart about who he's picking, and he's not to the peak of where he wants to be yet, so I don't think he's going to risk a loss yet. So I think he's picking people who he's very confident he's going to beat and have progressively bigger and bigger names. So that's why we saw him pick Ben Askren, big name, but like you were saying, didn't have the striking prowess. He knew going in, this is going to be kind of an easy win for me. Now he's picking a little bit of a harder challenge, but he's picking, isn't he like got a solid like 5 or 6 inches on Woodley?
Yeah, it is a little bit kind of like the Logan Paul versus Mayweather thing, where like Mayweather obviously is the superior boxer with technique, but Logan Paul was just a much bigger human. And that is why, you know, weight classes matter, because it's a lot harder, and Floyd's old and all that stuff, but it's a lot harder to like hurt someone when you're smaller. But Woodley's going to be coming in the heaviest he's ever come into a fight. Yeah. He's going to be probably right around 109. I think he weighed in at 190.5. Or 190, something like that. So he's going to be probably like right around that. I don't think he's going to be putting on that much more weight. And then Jake will probably be around 200. So it'll only be like 10 pounds, where like the Mayweather-Logan Paul fight was like 40, I think, pounds. I think Logan had him by. So I don't think the height height's going to be that big. Woodley has fought Wonder Boy, who has a couple inches on him. I'm trying to think. He's probably fought a couple other people, I'm sure, in his career that were like taller. So I don't know if that's going to be the deciding factor in the fight. I'm going to go ahead and say that I think, gosh, this is wild. I think anyone can win. Mm-hmm. So I think this is the first fight that Jake has put himself in that he could lose. He wasn't going to lose to Nate Robinson. He wasn't going to lose to Ben Askren. This is the first fight that I think he can lose. And, man, it's going to be crazy to see what happens, because I think if Tyron goes out there and sleeps him in like the first round, I think it's going to be much harder for Jake to like move forward.
That's what I'm saying.
It's going to be very difficult for him to continue this kind of,
because he's story. Not, in my mind, Jake Paul's not going to want to fight a boxer until he's able to fight like a pretty big name boxer. He's not going to go fight a no name boxer.
I think he fights one more UFC guy.
Yeah.
Or he fights Fury. So Tommy Fury is Tyson Fury? Yeah, Tyson Fury. Tyson Fury, who is the heavyweight champion of the world, his younger brother is Tommy Fury, who is fighting on this same card.
Mm-hmm.
So if Tommy, and they've already kind of had a little bit of like trash talking back and forth. So I think if Tommy Fury comes out, puts a good performance on, and Jake Paul ends up winning, I think that will probably be the next fight, because Tommy Fury is a boxer.
Yeah.
Also, Tommy Fury has the brother that is the champion of the world. Like, there's a lot of stuff that you can kind of go that route. But I think where Jake is right now, I think this is going to be obviously the scariest fight for him. And I think if he does end up winning, like the next level is he's getting to the point of where it's like, it's tough for him to continue to like go up slowly.
Yeah.
Like I think the next jump is going to be a pretty drastic jump, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm just
with
saying,
all that being said, I think Woodley catches him and I think Woodley wins.
Interesting. See, cause I'm looking at it like Jake Paul is not looking at boxing as like, he's going to grind it out. He's trying to get to a certain level of like fame and notoriety so he can make money, right? He's coming into boxing as like, he wants to be a great boxer, but he knows this is a pretty quick and easy way for him to make a lot of money per fight.
I think it's different than Logan. I think Logan is thinking that way more of where like, what's the big fight money-wise? I think that's what Logan's all about is because Logan fighting Floyd did nothing. It was unsanctioned. Yeah, it wasn't a professional fight, but I think it was probably unsanctioned because of the different weight classes. Jake, I think, legitimately thinks he has a chance of being a champion.
But he's not. That's what I'm saying. He needs to get to the level. So he's not going to risk it this early on a fight that he's not 100% confident in. And
but
so I think he's looking at it from
a.
I don't think this is the fight.
Okay.
Because I think he's looking at this right now still from a business perspective of where he wants to get, even if that
Woodley's
is.
Woodley's a beast, man.
The only
question is how much does MMA boxing, how much does MMA striking translate to boxing?
Is there a case of MMA striking translating well to boxing?
I think Anderson Silva just beat. I think Anderson Silva, who is an MMA guy, known for his striking, known for his head movement. He was at one point one of the best fighters in the world. I think he had the longest win streak as well. I think he literally just fought a biter. Yeah. He just fought a fighter. He fought Julio Cesar. Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. And I think he beat him. Yeah. And Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. I think is probably past his prime. But so is Anderson. Like they're both like kind of older dudes.
Yeah.
But I think Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. is like absolutely – oh, no. Julio's my age. I mean, okay, he could be past his prime. But he is my age. He's 35. So he's not terribly old. But he was he had 60 fights. This is his career. He had 60 fights. He won 34 by KO. He won 52 of the 60 and only lost 6. So I guess there was a couple no decisions in there. But like he's a big name in boxing.
I was thinking through the ones we've seen in my head. Like
there hasn't been that many that have tried it.
Well, yeah, but like Conor McGregor, obviously he went straight to Floyd. He did decent, but like
he gassed out. Yeah, but he did decent. Like he was winning.
I just think it's a different. It's just such. I agree. I think it's way harder to be a UFC fighter than it is to be a boxer, because of everything else you have to learn to be a UFC fighter, as far as defense and also being able to like do takedowns and all of that. Whereas boxing, it's literally just one aspect of MMA and UFC.
I think we can literally describe it similar to Ultimate Frisbee and Disc Golf. I think it's easier to go from Ultimate Frisbee to Disc Golf than it is to go from Disc Golf to Ultimate Frisbee.
So which is which in this scenario? Which is boxing?
So I think it's easier to go from we're not saying that you're going to be successful, but it's probably easier to go from UFC, like MMA, to boxing than it is to go from boxing to MMA. Because
So you're saying Ultimate's a lot harder to play than Disc Golf.
I'm saying it's harder. It'd be harder for a disc golfer to transition to Ultimate than it would be for an Ultimate player to transition to Disc Golf. Because, for example, let's say you're really, really good at disc. Yeah, I mean, there's athleticism involved.
Yeah.
So you might be really, really good at throwing, but you are slow.
Yeah.
So
okay.
So there's more factors. there's more things you have to be good at than just disc golf. You just have to be good at throwing. In ultimate, there's more things that you have to be good at. And it's the same thing in MMA. You have to be good at grappling, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, striking, all those things. So it's going to be way harder for someone that is really good at boxing to come into MMA. And you've seen it. Like, people will say, like, this guy has some of the best striking in MMA. And he goes up against a wrestler. And the wrestler just literally at the beginning of every round tackles him, keeps him on the ground. The guy doesn't know how to get up, and he wins.
Yeah.
And it's a boring fight, but the guy wins. So that's how I think it probably is similar that way to where – but that doesn't mean you're going to be good. I just think it's probably easier for those guys to just focus on boxing and only one element of mixed martial arts.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting. I'm still debating if I'm staying up to watch – or if I'm just going to wake up in the morning and learn. Because it's going to be like midnight my time.
Is it super late?
I think the card starts at 8 Eastern.
Well, it's on Showtime. It's not on these like trash social media things. Or like, you know, these other trash sites. So
they're actually going to pay them out. They're not going to steal all their money.
Yeah. And there won't be like 5 musical concerts going on.
Oh, yeah.
Fight, fight, fight. So I think it'll move a little bit faster. Okay. So I think at this point, guys, we probably, you know, if you're a podcast listener on Apple Podcasts, or are we on Spotify too?
Should be. Yeah.
All right. If you guys are listening to us, or if you're listening to us not live, try to tune in for the live. This is a show that we will eventually have a locked in day and time to where you guys can tune in. But for right now, we're going to open it to some live chat for a little bit, probably for like 15 minutes. So if you guys have any sort of things you maybe have, maybe some things that you disagreed with us from what we said tonight, some new topics, whatever, we're going to open it now, read some chat out, and then close it out, because my corgis right now are giving me the death stare. And I think that means they're hungry. So relax now. I'll feed you. Moose Man, stop eating the door.
While we wait for some to come in, because there's a little bit of a delay with the stream.
Are you going to keep track of the chat?
Yeah, I got it popped up here.
Okay, so if anything comes up good, let me know, because yeah. I'm trash at reading that stuff.
For sure. One thing I was going to say is I actually put this tweet out, and I'd be interested to get your perspective versus my perspective, since I've been in the sport a little bit longer, is you have to exclude Conrad's Envy, because that's the easiest one. But what would you say is like the most iconic disc in disc golf? So not like mold, but like in someone's bag. So like Conrad's Envy, for instance, and then can you even think of someone else's disc that you're like, that's iconic?
Probably my Dyed Get Freaky.
Oh, you're going with yours?
I don't know. I think a lot of people change a lot of discs in their bag constantly. So I think it's easy. You know, I'm seeing some people, like someone just said Calvin's Eagle. Like, I think, like, does he have the same Eagle that he's been throwing for 2 years? Or is
no, but
it
there
just...
is there are some cases like that. Like,
yeah, Barsby and his Sidewinder, I think, right? Or like, you've got, gosh, I don't know. I think like certain people are known for certain discs, right?
Yeah.
But I think what we're talking about is like a specific disc.
Yeah, like, for instance,
oh, that black disc that he has that has yellow, yeah, blah, blah, blah.
That's like the ones that came to my mind when I asked the question were Sexton used to have this cherry pie orc. It was an orc that had like a cross hatching. It was super, everyone knew it. Simon has a FD with Elsa dyed on it. Everyone knew that. And then Paul used to have this monster, or was it a monster? No, it was the monster logo dyed on a gator.
No,
it was a gator back when he was with Innova. Oh. That was iconic. And then his black on black zone. And then Ricky had some harps and stuff like that. But there's a few. But someone actually brought up a pretty good question here. It's from Fish21. He said, do you think that there is no lefty good enough to really compete, or are lefties just at a disadvantage in disc golf?
I think it's a mixture. I think there are obviously less lefties in the world than righties. So right then and there, it's probably going to be a lot harder to have, you know, in a tournament, you have, what, 140 people. How many of those people are left-handed? Probably not that many of them. So you already have a limited thing. And then I would say also, yes, a lot of courses are very backhand dominant, And so when I get to a course and I'm like, oh, wow, this course has like, because that's it. I talked to Zach Melton about this a lot. And for those that don't know, he's a left-handed player. And he was talking about how you would get to a course and they're like, oh, this is like a lefty-friendly course. And he's like, oh, really? And then he plays it and it's like the three or four holes that right-handed players are going to throw forehand, they're all like less than like 330 feet. So like everyone has that shot. Like everyone should have a 300 to 350 foot forehand, but not everyone has a 450 foot forehand. And so how many holes are there that the backhand hyzer is the best throw in the holes 450 feet? There's a lot, not a lot, but you know, there are holes like that. There's very few holes where the best shot is a 450 foot forehand. So that, I thought that was an interesting perspective coming from him, someone that is constantly playing on these courses.
Well, I also think another thing is a lot of times as a right-handed player, because I play with Zach Melton a lot, another good player, actually the best lefty in the world for a long time was Chris Clemens, but both of them have said on the record.
I think Chris Clemens is the best left-handed right now in the world.
He might still be, but both of them have said, where like right-handed players, as soon as we see a hole that we throw a forehand on, we immediately go, oh, that's a lefty hole. But one thing you have to remember too is a forehand flies different than a backhand.
Yes.
Because it doesn't have as much spin. So sometimes the hole that's meant for our forehand are actually some of the hardest lefty holes. Because the way the shot shape is supposed to be, it like will go dead straight and then hook hard left at the end. And it's a lot harder to get a backhand to actually do that than it is to get a forehand. So even the holes that are a lot of times considered lefty holes might not actually even be lefty holes. They're just righty forehand holes. So there might be some courses where you're thinking in your head, oh yeah, there's three or four lefty holes on that course. And it's like, realistically, there might be only one and there might be 17 righty holes. So I think it's what you said is true. I think it's a mix between there not being that many lefties percentage wise in the field to where we just haven't seen it. And also the courses, just the design of the courses just hinder them.
I think course design is a big thing. And I think, you know, in the future, they'll start looking more at trying to get a good mixture of backhand tee shots, forehand tee shots, and then also the same thing as approach shots, right? Where like not every approach shot is a backhand. Some are going to be forehands. I think that will be in the future for sure.
Yeah, so another great topic, I think we've actually talked about this a little bit before, but I don't remember exactly where it was at. This is suggested by Raymond. I'm going to rephrase it a little bit, but it's about marketing yourself, right? So what I want to hear is if you were to start playing disc golf, let's say that you fresh out of college, you don't have a YouTube following, you don't have a name, you don't have anything yet, and you decide you're going to play disc golf. With your knowledge now, what are you telling yourself back then to start focusing on to try to build your personal brand, within the realm of disc golf?
Get good.
All right, so that's now you're good. Now you're good. Now what do you do?
Now that I'm good, I show that off. And I show my passion. I show my love for the sport.
Are you doing that? Like, what's your main focus? Like, are you just picking one social media platform and you're chilling with it? Are you going to
across all? YouTube, if you enjoy making videos and you enjoy editing, YouTube's the platform for you. If you don't enjoy doing that, then I would probably say Instagram or nowadays TikTok would probably be the two there. But that's going to be the most important thing because it is so much easier. And gaming is a perfect example of this. you could be absolutely the most entertaining person in the world when it comes to streaming. Heck, you might not even have a face cam. You're just showing your gameplay, but you're so good at the game that people tune in to watch you play, right? Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to get people to follow you or be interested in you because you're good. Then the other way where it's like you're trying to be like entertaining or whatever. And like that's something that like is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pressure on me with that because I know I have to perform, you know, because at a certain time people are going to get like, they're going to be like, dude, you suck. What the heck are you doing? Like, I don't want to pay attention to you anymore. So there's a lot of pressure on me because I already have a following coming into disc golf. And obviously I have a bunch of ride or die people, which I 100% appreciate. But I know at a certain time people want results. And so I think if you're getting into something, the easiest way to create a following, to create value in your brand and yourself is to try to be the best in that field.
Yeah, that's I've never really thought of it from that perspective of get good first. Because I think that you can also take it from the perspective of document yourself getting good. Yeah. Like there's that, but you still have to get good.
It's going to be very difficult without a following to get people to tune in.
Yeah, if you're
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, like, again, like a lot of times, like, you're not going to have the production value. Because that's the thing is, like, if you have production value where you're doing videos that are like slow-mos, drone shots, like beautiful cinematography, the audio is great, like all this, then potentially people might tune in because it's like, holy cow, this is like incredible production.
Yeah.
But my guess is like if you're just getting – like the example you gave, like someone's probably going to be filming with their iPhone. They're probably not going to be that great at editing. So that's going to be tough to kind of have people pay attention to that from the beginning. And especially nowadays, like, dude, the amount – like think about how many podcasts there were about disc golf 2 years ago.
Yeah.
To how many there are now. Like, I just went on Apple Podcasts the other day and searched disc golf, and there's 50 plus podcasts I've never even heard about that are talking about disc golf. So the competition now is insane and is crazy. And there obviously are spots for people to kind of like foundation, kind of what you and Trevor are doing with Grip Loft. You know, you guys have the number one podcast in disc golf, and you guys don't tour. You guys aren't touring players. And I think that's easier to do than trying to be a touring player and have all this stuff,
yeah.
But you're not good. That's you. There needs to be like a separation between the two.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. For sure. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I've heard a lot of. Because on Grip Locked, one of the things we talk about all the time is how important a player's value is and how important a player's brand is. And the biggest question from that is like, okay, yeah, it's important, but like, how the heck do you do it? And yeah, I mean, I've always looked at it from, because I was...
And some people aren't going to be marketable.
Yeah.
Like, some people just aren't going to be marketable, and that's fine. It's okay. I think you just have to be true to yourself.
Yeah. I think that's one of the big things. I always looked at it from like the nerdy marketing side of posting consistently, you know, providing value, blah, blah, blah. All the stuff that you hear if you click on a Gary Vee video, you know what I mean? You're like basic social media marketing and be like, oh, you do that, you're good. But
like, what
it's got to be entertaining what they're watching.
But also, what if a million people do that?
No, yeah, the competition. That's why you got niche down.
Not all those people. Like, just because they, if a million people all of a sudden were like, oh, that's all I have to do, Gary Vee? Oh, easy. They all started. You're going to tell me all 1 million of those people are going to be successful? No. Like, what Gary, I'm not disagreeing with what Gary Vee is saying, because what he says, yes, those are the things that you need to be doing to be successful, but that it doesn't mean just because you do that, you will.
You will be.
And, and all you have to do is go to Twitch and see how many people are streaming to one person, to two people. And they're probably grinding their you-know-whats off every day. And it's just, it's tough, man. The competition out there is tough.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, unless you have another topic to bring up, I don't see a super, I don't see one jumping off the screen at me.
I will say, if you guys are listening to this, make sure you join the Discord. The link will be in the description of this YouTube video. So if you're listening to the audio version, just jump over to the YouTube. There is a channel in there called Debate Night, and I have, I think right now I have like 12 really good topics to pull in for the future for us from that channel. So if you have suggestions, if you want to hear our opinions on certain things, that is the perfect spot to put it in.
That's also a great way to get involved if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or one of the post-produced versions. That's a great way for you to get your voice heard when you might not be able to tune in live or call in when we're able to do that again or anything like that. I definitely think the Discord's a great thing. Also, don't forget to check out our Patreon where you'll get four episodes, bonus episodes of a podcast called The Bogey Bro Banter. It's a lot more laid back. Brody's on there sometimes. It's always Trevor and I. Connor pops in and talks a lot more. And then we also have, if you're on the $5 tier, you also get access to one exclusive video a month over on Patreon. So $5 gets you access to five pieces of content per month, plus all the backlogs of those contents. So you can go right now. I think we just posted number 8 for the Bogey Bro Banter. So there's 8 episodes waiting for you. There's also benefits to the higher tiers as well if you're interested in looking into more of that.
And those episodes too, like the nice thing about it is if you become a Patreon member like right now, all that stuff is unlocked. Mm-hmm. So you can go back and watch all 8 episodes. And the Bogey Banter too is one of those things too, is like it's not like super live in the sense of like you can go back and watch the first episode and be like, oh,
It's not time sensitive.
It's not time sensitive.
Most of the time we're picking whoever that day did something stupid is getting roasted for 30 to 40 minutes. And it's a great time. It's my favorite podcast we do. I mean, I like the disc golf analytics stuff. I enjoy debating, but I like just sitting down with a mic in front of me and just talking with my friends. I feel like that's what podcasting is.
I said, as soon as I get up there, I'm making it like I'm going to be on that podcast every single time I'm in town. It's like, I agree with you. It's the best one that I enjoy doing. Just because, like you said, it's just us sitting around talking about whatever. So
for sure. And if you are listening post-produced on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and you can't find the link, you can also just download the Discord app. Search in the directory and we should pop up that way nowadays. That didn't always used to be that simple. You used to have an invite link and all that, but now you can just search Foundation Disc Golf.
Big time, baby.
Yeah, that was a big drastic improvement. But thank you all so much for tuning in, whether you're tuning in live or tuning in later. We really appreciate each and every one of you. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please go ahead and leave us a review. We read each and every one of them, and we're going to be implementing stuff from those reviews to make changes. And hopefully come next week or the week after, we'll be able to finally have an official time and date that this is going live so you can plan that into your schedule and into your lives as well and hang out with us each and every week. But other than that, we really appreciate you tuning in, and we will talk to you all next week.
Peace!
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Saving on your education should be a right, not a competition. At University of Phoenix, our bachelor's and master's scholarships are accessible to all. You'll get the best scholarship or savings you qualify for. Simple as that. Because everyone deserves an opportunity to save on their education without competing for it. Explore scholarship options at University of Phoenix.
Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.